This is HPR episode 2150 entitled, Apollo Guidance Computer, and is part of the series, Interviews. It is hosted by Ken Forlan, and is about 73 minutes long. The summary is, François Rautenbach tell us how he is hacking 50-year-old computers.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ken Fallon, and you're listening to another episode of Hacker Public Radio. I have got an awesome interview for you today. Back some time ago, I was introduced to, everybody can remember the Apollo missions to the moon. And I came across this website, thankfully provided by his brother, and I came across the opportunity to interview François Rautenbach. Is that right? Rautenbach?
Rautenbach, yeah.
Okay. François, you're calling in from South Africa at the minute.
That's great, yes.
So you have put together on your YouTube channel, links in the show notes, some excellent videos on the Apollo Guidance Computer. Can you just give us a brief overview about what the Apollo Guidance Computer is and why it was built?
Yes, Ken. So basically, about 2 years ago, I started reading up about the Apollo Guidance Computer, and I got some really interesting information about it. You know, we grew up with this idea that the Apollo Guidance Computer was no more powerful than a programmable calculator, and I found out that it was completely wrong. You know, this was a real computer. It wasn't that fast. It didn't have that much memory, but it was quite powerful. And the purpose of the Apollo Guidance Computer was basically to, first of all, navigate the astronauts to the moon in the command module. And then there was a second Apollo Guidance Computer in the lunar module. And that was actually the primary purpose for it, to actually land on the moon. So the Guidance Computer took the lunar lander through all the phases and, you know, sort of braking phases and descent phases all the way almost right up to the point where it landed on the moon. Right at the end, Neil Armstrong actually took over manually and physically landed the lunar module, but the computer could have landed it as well. They just preferred to do that last step under sort of manual control. So the Apollo Guidance Computer was quite important. It was the one thing that made it possible for them to actually land on the moon. Without that, they wouldn't have been able to do that.
So what did it actually control? The thrusters and orientation and stuff like that?
Yeah, all of that and more. I think, you know, if I quickly go back, but the Apollo Guidance Computer had something like over 200 inputs and outputs. So it was monitoring not just sort of alignments and the position, the sort of geospatial position of the craft, but it was monitoring all sorts of pressures and sensors, and it controlled all the thrusters. For instance, the lunar module itself had four sets of four thrusters around the lunar module. So there's 16 thrusters just around the module, just keeping it upright. And then there was the main engines, and then there was sort of gimbals that had to be monitored, and engines that had to be sort of moved slightly to change the center of gravity of the thrust. And so there was a whole bunch of things that it had to monitor and control, and it was all from one computer, basically.
And it presumably had some sort of gyroscope to keep it level and centered, yeah.
That's right, yes. So the gyroscope was developed by MIT in the 1950s, and it was sort of an evolution, and that's why they were able to get the contract for the guidance computer, because they had all this guidance navigation thing already under control with the gyros or the gimbals, all of that. And they were able to control the or to determine the position of a craft anywhere in a three-dimensional space. If you knew where you were, then you can actually get to a point, further on. If you were orbiting the Earth and you knew exactly where you were at that point, then you could navigate your position or your craft from that point to the moon. And that was all the navigation stuff that MIT had developed. And the guidance computer was just a natural evolution to that mechanical system.
Wow. What's a gimbal?
It's the gyros. This is a interesting story, but normally you would need three sort of gyros turning in inside one another. So you had three gyros inside one another, and these gyros, doesn't matter how the craft would move, these gyros would always stay level and they would stay in one position.
So giving you an X, Y, and Z coordinate, I guess, yeah.
Exactly, yes. But there's sort of a snag there that when these gimbals, when you get to a certain point where all the axes are aligned in a straight line and you would tilt, then you would get something called a gimbal lock. Where these gyros would sort of just spin out of control and they would just lose their alignment. So you needed a third, that third axis. Now with the Apollo guidance computer inside of the command module, they didn't have that. They tried to save space and they tried to, not do that. So they opted for a simpler sort of gimbal gyros kind of system. And it came back and bit them a little bit. Apollo 12, for instance, while it was taking off, it was hit by lightning twice. And the batteries went down and the whole computer reset it a few times. And there was a chaos there. The computer wasn't damaged at all. They tested it, after the launch, they tested everything and everything was fine. But they lost gimbal, the gyros was basically just spinning. So they lost their position completely and they had to recalibrate the gimbals in space. From Earth stations, they actually had to find out where is this craft, where's the position around the Earth. Then they had to transmit, you are over here, and realign your gimbals and, so it would know where it was, basically.
Yeah, start point X. Mm-hmm. And then
that's right. Yeah.
You would also need to know, where the Earth and the Moon are and all variations of that over time.
That's
as you're moving out. Mm. Wow, that is actually quite impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to give you an idea of how difficult it is to actually fly to the Moon, there's a company, I can't remember the name now, but they develop software to sort of plot your route to the Moon. If you want to fly to the Moon, you use all their maths and their algorithms and the constants that they've already determined. Now there's over 5,000 parameters can affect your flight to the Moon. So there's over 5,000 things that they need to know to be able to get you to the Moon. So it's quite a complex thing to get to the Moon. And if you fly from the Earth to the Moon, then you don't fly directly to the Moon. You actually aim at a point in front of the Moon, and you have to know exactly how fast you're going and how fast the Moon's going, so that by the time that you get to that position, you're right in front of the Moon. Now, if you get it slightly wrong, you're going to fly right past the Moon. You're going to end up in space and going on forever. If you get it slightly wrong the other way, then you're going to fly right into the Moon. So you have to fly right in front of the Moon. It's basically like running in front of a bus and just missing it, And if you're passing in front of the Moon and then the Moon catches you in its a gravity field and it slings you around the Moon, and then you just fire the engines once or twice and then you're in orbit around the Moon. So you have to get it absolutely right. So that's actually quite a critical part in the mission.
Yeah, for episode 2000, I did a show on pointing satellite dishes and how satellite works. So orbit is nothing more than falling at the same rate. So you're falling around the moon, but not enough to crash in, but not enough to go away. So this is an amazing feat of engineering from something. How old would this have been? It was 1966 it's introduced, so 2 years before I was born.
Well, the computer was actually the first prototype came off the production line in 1964. And this is why, you know, I've had some sort of discussions with people who said, you know, the Minuteman missile had the first guidance computer because that was launched in 1965. And yes, it was launched in 1965, and the Apollo guidance computer was launched in 1966. But by 1966, the Apollo guidance computer was already working for about 2 years now. You know, it was already in production. They had production versions, training versions. So this thing was around since late 1964. And it was actually, they had working versions of it already as early back as 1962.
Wow. I don't know how old you are, but do you remember this? How did you start become passionate about where does your interest in the Apollo missions come from?
It's basically from a few point of angles, but you know, I was born in 65, so you know, when the first missions went up, you know, I was really actually too small to realize that, you know. I just remember my dad
were there
listening to the radio, and it was like, oh, they're going to the moon. You know, you're going to the drive-ins, and you see these Saturn V rockets launching. So you grow up with these things, and then they disappeared. Then they, that was it. And, you know, my background is more into computers and, you know, developing software and designing hardware and that sort of thing. And at some point, you know, I started thinking back, you know, like, what was this about? You know, what was the story there? And then I discovered there was a computer in there, and that computer used integrated circuits. And my perception of computers was integrated circuits is something that happened in the 70s, you know.
I was going to say that.
I didn't, you know, sort of think that integrated circuits was used in 1961 to build a computer. And this computer had ROM, and it had RAM, and it had I/O ports and counters and timers, and it could do integrations and all sorts of complex math. And it was around in 1961. So that intrigued me, basically.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to jump all over the place here as I think of questions. But surely the integrated circuits, I mean, there was a lot of development in order to get to the moon, but that's a big jump to get integrated circuits. Where were we? You know, I guess there were a lot of developments with the V2 rocket, but that surely didn't have any, you know, going from there, which is at the end of 1945 to what, 10 something years later, 20?
About 20 years or 15 years at least later.
Yeah.
This was, you know, that's also an interesting thing. You know, it's like technology, you need to sort of learn and get comfortable with a new sort of idea. You know, when the first rockets were built, I think about every second rocket exploded. You know, these things went off course. They just went crazy, flying all over the place. And as these guys started understanding how to keep a rocket, you know, upright and make it go up and not sort of sideways,
basically.
They realized that, you know, you need to control this thing. You know, you need to take the engines, and you don't really see that, but those engines in the bottom, they actually move slightly. So if the rocket kind of tilts to the one side, they would just slightly shift these engines, you know, to sort of push it back onto its path there. So there's a lot of things that happened there. And a natural thing was to have some kind of electronic circuit that could control this rocket and understand that it's tilting over by a half a degree or whatever. The one thing with a rocket is the thing you need least is weight. Everything needs to be extremely lightweight because you can't lift a lot of stuff. And if you have to put a computer in a rocket, now you have to think back in the early 1960s, you know, if somebody talked about a computer, a computer was something that occupied a room, a huge big room, and there was a lot of people working on this computer. So when NASA said, okay, we need a computer in this rocket, those people, they didn't think about a little laptop or a, you know, kind of thing. They were thinking like, how can we put this room in a rocket?
Yes.
Now, I've actually got a drawing where people drew this whole thing with tapes spinning and printers printing, and this is all in a capsule, because that was what they thought a computer looked like. You know, a computer is something that fits in a room. You need to put that room in a rocket. So MIT said, you know, they propose, let's build a miniaturized computer. That was the exact words they used. They said, can we build a miniaturized computer? And they started building this computer with transistors. And this computer ended up being like about four refrigerator size sort of cabinets. And they said, okay, can we fit this in a computer, in a command module in a spaceship? So one of the guys went to a meeting in another city, and he came back and he said, guys, big problem. These guys gave us 1 square foot to put the computer in.
Wow.
And everybody said, no, okay, we've got 4 refrigerator size cabinets here, and we need to put this in 1 square foot. So how are we going to do this? And there was this program just before the Apollo thing, the Polaris missile project, and they wanted to use these really small new invention called integrated circuits in this. And they ordered these integrated circuits from Texas Instruments. But Texas Instruments, the process wasn't, you know, sort of streamlined yet. And they built these integrated circuits with by hand, each chip individually by hand. They would actually etch the transistors and the resistors on the chip, but then they would take little, I think it was tin wires or something, and they would weld it onto the chip, make the tracks with that. So it was an incredibly slow process. And Texas Instruments quoted MIT $1,000 per chip. And even at that price, MIT ordered 60 of these chips. Now imagine 1960 prices.
Yeah.
$60,000 for a handful of chips. And they were willing to pay that because they wanted to get this Polaris missile like really small. Anyway, Texas Instruments only delivered the chips about a year and a half later in 1962, which was way too late for the Polaris missile. But by that time, there was also another company called Signetics. They've been bought out a couple of times, but they were the first to actually make commercially viable integrated circuits. And they built these really small chips, and they said, okay, we can deliver these things for $40 a piece, which was way better than $1,000 a piece. So MIT bought, you know, I think about 1,000 of these chips, if I remember correctly, and they started prototyping the Apollo guidance computer with these chips. And these chips was actually ordered for the Polaris missile, but they ended up being used in the Apollo program. And this is why a lot of people don't know that it was actually used in the Apollo program. They were the first.
Oh, okay. It's amazing to think that it was only in 1947, at the end of 1947, beginning of 1948, when the first transistor appeared on the scene.
That's right. Yes. Oh, yeah. And I mean, just over 10 years later, they had integrated circuits.
Yeah, and $1,000 will be around $8,000 now in today's money. So wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a lot of money for one. And it had 3 transistors and 4 resistors in there. That's it.
You know. Oh wow. So, paint me. So, did they manage to get it down to a square foot then in the end?
Yeah, they did actually get it down to that. But it took a couple of iterations and squeezing it in, and they managed to get that going. I think the first computer had something like it was close to 5,000. Of these little integrated circuits, and they pack them really tightly. There's some nice videos on the internet, on YouTube actually, if you want to see how that was done. But they went to NASA and they said, we have to use this new technology, and can we please use this? And everybody said, you're not going to get that past NASA. You know, they're not going to try the bleeding edge kind of technology. And they fell for it. They went for it. And the one thing that I want to say is that it's because MIT used these chips, and they tried these chips, and the chips was like horribly bad initially. You know, in a batch of 5,000 chips, they would find a lot of them that wasn't working. So they said, if we can get a batch of 5,000 chips and there's not one chip faulty in that batch, then we will grade that for space use. Otherwise, we're not going to use it for space use. So all these manufacturers, went in and they tendered and said, we can deliver batches, that's perfect. And they were all competing with each other to get this the perfect 5,000 batch of chips. And in the end, they had storage rooms full of chips that just didn't make it, you know, batch with one or two faulty. And, MIT would pay a premium for the ones that's like really good. And then what happened was at some point they said, what are we going to do with all these chips in the storage room? I mean, we ordered literally millions of dollars of chips now, and we're not going to use them for space use. And they said, well, let's force the guys building the what they call the ground support equipment. Let's force these guys to use chips. Let's tell them, we've already paid for this stuff. Here it is. You have to design using this. And because of that, a whole generation of engineers grew up designing with integrated circuits. And that is a major thing, because when these guys, went after the Apollo program, obviously, they went into the industry and they said, absolutely, well, I know how to use chips. And everybody started using chips, and the whole industry had been kickstarted by NASA, who were willing to pay a lot of money to get, just the first batch, the first, sort of prototype chips, and evolve it and make it stable. So I believe that, this is my personal belief, that the Apollo Guidance Computer is, that kickstarted this computer revolution by at least, it advanced us by at least 5 years, I'm sure.
Listening to this, and you hear like Velcro and stuff was not developed by NASA, and we should really give credit where credit is due, because I did not genuinely realize that there were integrated circuits on that, how advanced those computers were, until I watched some of your videos.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, no, it's pretty amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. So okay, you got interested. What's your background? You said you were working hardware and software. You have some really nice kit on your videos, by the way.
Yeah, no, except my power supply. I had a nice power supply, but that sort of packed up shortly before making those videos, so I had to go to a backup little analog power supply. But yeah, I designed a sort of digital hardware. I'm not really an analog guy that much, more into the microcontrollers, embedded microcontrollers, that sort of stuff. So for the guys working with PIC microprocessors or microcontrollers and the Atmel microcontrollers, that's the sort of stuff that I use a lot. Then I also write firmware running on that, and all the way up to even web servers and network protocols and that sort of stuff. So I try not to specialize too much in one specific area.
Okay, cool. And so how did... So when exactly did you become interested in the Apollo mission, and where did you go then from there?
I think what sparked my interest was I saw a book on the internet at one point. It was a book that it explained the Apollo Guidance Computer. I'm trying to remember the name here. I've got it. It was a book by Frank O'Brien, the Apollo Guidance Computer. And that book was a very technical book, and it explained in quite detail how the Apollo Guidance Computer worked, and all the different parts and pieces in it, and basically how the software worked, the instructions of that computer. I bought it to actually read at night, sort of before going to bed, but it's not really bedtime reading material. That's seriously technical sort of stuff. So if you're into that kind of thing, it's quite intense, and it shows you exactly how that computer was built, and a lot of interesting things. And that sparked my interest in the Apollo thing. And one thing led to another, and I ended up getting hold of these rope memories.
So tell us what this rope memory is, and what part it played in the guidance computer.
Okay, so the rope memory is actually like a ROM, like a read-only memory. I know, some people think it's like a core memory. You get core memory, which is actually RAM. We've seen it a lot. It's been used even up till the early 1980s. Mainframes used core memory. And it's if you see some really old boards with these small little miniature cores with three wires being tracing through those, that's core memory. Rope memory is actually something slightly different, and it works in a very different principle as well. It works on the principle of a transformer. So if you have a primary winding through a transformer and you put a little bit of current on that, you can pick it up on a secondary coil on that transformer without a physical connection between the two coils. Now, the rope memory works in exactly the same thing, except that there's not just a secondary winding. There's 128 wires.
Hello? Frank, you just dropped off there. Can you hear me still?
Yes, I can hear you.
I lost you at there's 128 wires. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. So there's 128 secondary wires winded through this core, this transformer core. And if you pulse the primary coil or wire, you would actually pick up the signals in all the 128 secondary wires.
Okay.
Now, if you take some of these secondary wires and you bypass the coil, so you don't wrap them through the core, but around the core, then they won't show any signals. But all the wires that's going through the core will actually, have an induced current, a current induced in them, and you'll see a signal on those wires. And that's how they differentiate between the zeros and the ones. So the principle behind the core rope memory is that it's little transformer coils. There's 512 of these little transformer rings, toroidal cores in a rope memory. And in a factory, this that video on my YouTube video shows that quite clearly, how these wires are winded through these cores or around the cores. And in the end, you sit with a memory that's 8 kilobytes in size of in the size of one module.
Okay, I'm going to have just need to just need to what? Sorry, finish your sentence, because I'm going to need to explain this to people.
Yes. So you just need to pulse the right cores, and then you get the signals, the data coming out of that.
Well, I 100% understand everything that you just said, but just to play devil's advocate for a moment here, for people who haven't seen the video. Now, some of your videos are absolutely excellent, but it's a video, a black and white video, recorded at the time, and it shows ladies with a needles. And to describe it to the people listening, imagine a 1U 19-inch rack with lots of holes in it, literally as many holes as you can possibly put in a 1U 19-inch rack. And they're threading a needle from one side right across to their working partner on the other side, who threads it back to another one right through and back. So that is a transformer in in my mechanical engineering experience here. I'm trying to see if I was doing an AC to DC, or let's say a step down from a 240 or 110 volt, let's say 110 for our US listeners, down to 12 volt DC, for example, I would have more coils on one side than I would have on the other side. That's how a transformer works, correct?
That's right, yes. So with the cores, they actually don't even wind it a couple of times through the core. They only push the wire through the core once.
Yeah.
And both the primary and secondary wires are just threaded through the core once, and that's enough, because you don't want to step up or down or anything like that. You just need to put a 14 volt pulse on the primary wire, and then you're going to find that there's maybe 100 or 200 millivolt pulse on the secondary wires, and that's all you need to see.
So I'm trying to get my head around this. So if I was trying to write a binary one, for instance, I would both of them through the core.
That's right. Yes.
If I was trying to write a zero, I would have the same wire going through, but the other wire not going through.
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
So I could then build up a word. A one and a zero would be one of the wires going through and one of the wires not going through.
Exactly. Yes. So with 128 wires, on average, you would probably get 64 wires going through the core and 64 wires going around the core. And there might be a little bit of variation on that, but that's the sort of general principle. And if you pulse the primary wire once, and all 128 wires, you're either going to, half of them might be zeros, half of them might be ones. So the ones that going through the cores will show a little pulse coming out of those wires, and the ones going around the cores will obviously not see anything significant.
Okay, so this would be, in essence, something, a USB stick, for want of a better word.
Yeah,
the ability to store a program even when the power was off.
That's right, yes. And these things, I mean, because it's physically wired, like I said earlier, Apollo 12 got hit by lightning twice, and it didn't even damage the computer. There was no damage at all. The computer worked perfectly. You try that with a computer today, it's not going to be... the smoke is going to come out.
And when we say it's physically wired, I mean this thing was physically wired. It is
exactly
like physical wire has been knitted. You've knitted in. So I just want to explain that. So at the time we're talking, storage of computer programs was done on ticker tape, if I'm correct. And in one of the videos I saw, the computer program was being read out by a ticker tape machine, and that ticker tape machine was positioning a sort of loop for the ladies to use as a guide where to thread this ROM memory, rope memory.
That's correct, yes. In fact, this is another interesting story. IBM actually competed with MIT. They said, you know, we can build a better computer and we don't believe in this integrated circuits. IBM actually only started using integrated circuits in the early 1970s. But they competed with MIT, and they said, we can build a smaller computer, faster computer, and they couldn't. But IBM's solution actually consisted of a drum that was spinning and with a head inside of the drum, and they didn't have a ROM. The drum would spin so fast that and you would keep track of where this drum was. So if you want to get the first instruction in the memory, you would wait for the the index pulse for this drum, and then you would quickly pick up the first instruction.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to execute the second instruction, you had to wait for the drum to complete a full circle again and go to the second instruction. So it's like a hard drive in a sense,
but
reading
disk,
the instructions, and reading the instructions from that and executing sort of on the fly. Now, obviously, that was way slower than the rope memories. And also, you know, in a spacecraft, you don't want spinning things and mechanical things that could damage, and also sort of magnetic drums and so on. Radiation and all of that could interfere with that. So the rope memory was absolutely suited for the space program.
Wow, absolutely amazing. And you got your hands on some of this. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's another story again. About 2 years ago, I was sort of browsing on the internet and looking for Apollo stuff. And I came across, you know, on eBay, there was a guy selling some of these modules. So I ordered one of them. I actually, managed to win the auction and got one of these modules. And that the module came out of what they call the DISKI, the display and keyboard device. That was the screen and keyboard that the astronauts used to enter the commands and the data inside the command module and the lunar module as well. So I got one of these modules that came out of the DISKI. After I received the module, I got into contact with a guy who shipped it to me, and I said, you know, where did you get these things? I mean, it's like, this is pretty amazing. This is something from the mid-1960s, and I mean, you don't just pick this up. And he says, oh, no, you've got a few, you know, bought it a few years back. And we started communicating, and he sent me some pictures of things that he had, some modules that he already sold and things that he still has. So at one point he sent me a photograph of these six modules, and on the modules it said Flight 202. Now at the time I had no idea what Flight 202 was. I mean, it didn't mean anything to me. So I started Googling, and I came across this Flight AS202. The AS stands for Apollo Saturn. Now there was a Flight AS201. That was the first official Apollo rocket to be launched. And then the second Apollo rocket to be launched was actually Flight 203, because it was very simple and it was ready before Flight 202. So Flight 203 was launched second. And then Flight AS202 was launched on 25th of August 1966. And wow. You know, I thought flight AS202, you know, it this sounds to me like the and then I googled some more and I found out that AS202 actually contained the first Apollo Guidance computer. So that was the first Apollo Guidance computer that was launched. It was an unmanned flight, but it was the first computer that was launched. And, you know, here's the six rogue memory modules containing the software, you know.
Where did that end up going?
I ended up sort of reading up a lot about these rogue memories, and there's lots of documentation on the rogue memories, but you know, the problem is some of this documentation comes from the early 1960s, you know, 1960, yeah. 1961, and you read that and it explains exactly how these things work, and then you look at a module and you say it doesn't work like that. It used to probably work like that, but it doesn't anymore. So you need to sift through all this information and sort of filter out all the things that's not applicable. And there was also the Block 2, the later Apollo Guidance computer, and that information is not applicable either. So eventually I managed to find out quite a lot about the rogue memories, how they function, how they work. And I managed to get a rogue memory from the same guy, but not from the flight AS202 one, get a sample rogue memory. And I played with that and I built a rogue memory reader, just a little hacked together device that would allow me to select the different lines and pulse the cores and get the signals coming back and record that. And then
is that the one in your video?
That was one of the ones in the video. But guys, I also have the 202 ones in the video. Yeah.
If you when he says rough and ready, if you remember Back to the Future, the famous excuse the crudity of the diagram, these are laser cross rigs, and it's absolutely mesmerizing to watch. If you have no interest in this show whatsoever, go look at that video because it's absolutely mesmerizing.
I've been actually been spending many hours sort of watching these relays click and sort of going through these signals. I've spent a part of my life doing that. But last year, about a year ago, I flew to Houston with my rogue memory reader, set it up in a hotel room, and the guy gave me one rogue memory from AS202 and he said, try and see if you can read this. And I read it. I managed to capture the data from that. The rogue reader wasn't perfect at that point yet. I managed to capture like 3/4 of the rogue memory, but it was because of a software bug that I didn't capture the last quarter, the last 25%, but that was my mistake. But I managed to capture most of the data from these rogue memories. In the meantime, the last year, I've actually perfected my rogue reader. I've gone through the data that I've captured, and you know, to give you an idea how difficult this is to capture, I once just did a little sum to calculate how many combinations and permutations are there, because you end up with a box of zeros and ones. You don't know what belongs where. Is this part of that? Is the address a sequential, or are you jumping all over the place? Because you don't know. There's no documentation about this. And there was literally billions and billions and billions of combinations. So at some point last year, end of last year, I thought, we'll never be able to get this. You know, this is a lost case. You know, I've got the data, but nobody knows what the order is of the zeros and ones in this memory. Yeah. And then I got a few lucky breaks, and I've recorded most of the video, but, you know, over time, and I just need to put all of this together for the third video in that series, where I'm going to show how I managed to find out what the address lines is. Where's address line 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? And the data lines, there's data line 0 all the way to data line 15, 16 data lines.
16 data lines, I've lost you after that. Hello? We may have lost Francois. One second. Hi, you're back.
Yes.
I lost you after that, yeah. 16 data lines.
Okay. I think you'll probably have to cut and paste here a bit.
No. We don't edit shows. Some people do. I don't.
Okay. No. Sure. Okay. So there's 16 data lines, and there's no documentation that tells you what is data line 0, 1, or 2, or 3. It's just a wild guess. You start at one point and you say, okay, let's assume that is data line 0, and you go all the way to 15. Now, the same sort of you have the same problem with the address lines. You can't There's no documentation that tells you where what is. So I've got all this data, and I managed to make a few small breakthroughs in sort of solving that problem, which data line is which data line, and the address lines. I've got another video. I've recorded most of that, and that will be on YouTube pretty soon. So that's the third video in that series.
Yeah. Don't want to give us a sneak preview or anything.
Yeah, there's a one of the biggest sort of discoveries that I've kind of made is there's a guy by the name Ron Burkey, which he did a lot of work on the Apollo stuff. You know, not just the guidance computer, but virtually everything about the Apollo stuff is on his website. One of the data maps that he uploaded to the internet showed that there was, it's just octal numbers of this rogue memory. And I looked at that and it didn't mean anything to me. And then around about the same time, I read a reply that was written by the first programmer on the Apollo guidance computer. And he wrote something, and somebody said something in his book, and he said, no, you're not 100% correct. This is the way it is. And he just elaborated a bit. And there was one little sentence he said. In the Block 2 computer, things don't work like this anymore. And he said, the checksum in the Block 2 now works like this, not like this anymore. And that little sentence actually,
wow.
That was the thing that said, okay, so this is the way it worked in Block 1. And I looked at the code and I saw some values that didn't make sense. And I remembered this, and I remembered the hex dump that I saw from Ron Burkey's website, and all of these things came together. And in the end, I realized, you know, if I shuffle the data like this, and all the funny values, the weird values moved right to the end of the rope memory, and everything started falling into place. So that was the key moment. Yeah.
I hope you had a good whiskey for that, or at least a nice refreshing beverage.
Well, I didn't sleep that night, so yeah, that was quite exciting.
Wow, this is unbelievable. So can you tell us a bit about your reader, what you did and how you put it together, what it consists of?
Yeah, so when I started with the rope memory, I had a rough idea of how it worked, and I knew that, you know, I'm going to experiment with it and things are going to change and I'm going to learn things as I go on. So I couldn't build a rope reader that's fixed and, you know, sort of final. I had to do something that was that I could experiment with. So I built these three little relay boards, and each relay board had 16 relays on it. And the relays was wired in such a way that I could, just using standard wire wrapping sort of wire, I could interconnect these relays in any kind of way. So the relays doesn't really do any of the reading of the ropes. They basically just route the signals through to the rope memory. So I need to sort of put pulses on certain wires and sense other wires, and that's what the relays do for me. They sort of, like a telephone exchange, they would route the signals through to the correct pins to read that one specific bit. So I built these three relay boards, and I just, the first relay board would just do the lower seven address lines. The next relay board would do the 16 bits, would route one of those 16 bits through for me, so I can just look at that one specific bit. And then the third board had a dual purpose, did the rest of the address lines and what they call the core inhibit lines. It's actually a pretty simple sort of system, but it allowed me to experiment and try different sort of things until I managed to get the right data out of that.
And it's still reliable. Are you getting reliable data off it?
Yeah. I haven't yet managed to capture the zeros and ones in a file. You know, it's at this point in time, it's basically waves. It's raw data. I can, you know, with the eye, I can look at the data. I can see that's a one, that's a zero, that's a one.
Yeah.
And I would write it down by hand, and going right to the end of the memory, I could see that there's empty space right at the end of the memory. And that's also an interesting thing. If you've done any kind of low-level programming on a Pentium processor, you know that there's something called that you can get a page fault in memory if there's no physical memory in that address, and you try and access memory in that address, you would get a page fault.
Yeah.
Well, the guidance computer, Apollo guidance computer, has got a page fault system. The absolute end of a rope memory that doesn't contain any software is actually explicitly they made a fault in that memory, and that the parity is incorrect in that memory. So if you jump into that memory, you would get a parity error, and the computer would reset, and it would just carry on what it was doing last. So it had a page fault, and that page fault, I managed to move all of that data to the end of the rope memory. I looked at that. I looked at the 3 bytes preceding that end of the memory, and I could see the checksum byte called the bugger word. I managed to find that in there. And then the 2 words just prior to that is what they call the TC self. Now, I need to explain that. TC is a jump instruction or a go-to instruction in your Apollo guidance computer. And it means TC self means go to myself, you know, so it goes into an endless loop. And they marked the end of the software with 2 TC selves. So a jump to its own address, and the next instruction would also be a jump to its own address, and then there would be a checksum value. And if they did diagnostics on the software, they would start at the beginning of the memory, run through the memory until they found a TC self, another TC self, and then they would know the next byte is a checksum. Don't read past that point, you're going to crash. You're going to get a parity error. And I found those things. They are in the memory. The TC cells helped me to sort of find out what the data line order was. So I found all of that information. It is in there. It's exactly as the documentation said it would be.
Wow. Excellent. And you could then, knowing where you are, work your way back.
That's right. Yeah. So it's going backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And in the end, you know, it starts all falling together, coming together. And I think we're there.
Okay, so you meet a strange guy in a bedroom in the US. Then what happened?
So I read the memories. You know, I was quite pressed for time there. I only had a limited time there. And a hotel room is not the sort of best place. You know, the lighting isn't good enough. And I lost my reading glasses, you know, sort of going there. Misplaced them somewhere, so I didn't have my reading glasses when I was half blind, you know, bad lighting, didn't have my soldering iron with me. Even if I took it up over there, you know, we used 220 volts, they used 110 volts, you know, it wouldn't have worked. So I had to go and buy myself a soldering iron. It was really grabbing, you know, sort of working in a non-ideal sort of environment. But I managed to read the data, and the data that I've got right now, the data that I managed to crack was based on that original data that I read there. And I've got a whole new set of data now that I will release quite soon.
Did you get any more modules? That was not the other modules, was it?
Yeah. Well, there were more modules. So we've got the Flight 202. We've got the full set of 6 rope memories for Flight 202. Then there's another set of rope memories from Flight 501. Now, Flight 501 was Apollo 4. And Apollo 4 was the first time that the Saturn V rocket was launched. So that was in the Saturn V rocket, the Apollo 4 rocket, the Saturn V. We've got on the 501 ropes, we've got 5 out of the 6. And this is quite curious, is the missing rope on Flight 501, we've got a rope with exactly the right number that should go in there, but it's not marked as Flight 501. Oh. So that's a bit of a mystery. You know, what's the odds that there's a spare one and that spare one just fits into that slot, but it doesn't have the right markings. So yes, we have that. The flight, I'm pretty sure we've got the full set of Flight 501. I think that other one, the unmarked one, was probably taken out and replaced at quite a late stage, and it just wasn't marked. That makes a lot of sense, but we'll see when we've captured that data from there as well. So I've got some of that rope data as well that I've captured in the time that I was in Houston. I couldn't capture all of them. It took quite a long time to read the entire memory and get all the data correctly out of it. So I didn't manage to capture the entire 501 rogue memory modules, you know, all the data in that. But I got most of that.
Oh, very good. Very good.
And then, you know, I can add to my surprise, the second last day that I was in Houston, the guy said, you know, come down, I've got something for you to have a look at. And I went down and there was this big sort of container that I had to carry up, incredibly heavy container for me. And there was a Block 2 Apollo Guidance computer, the actual computer, you know, and I was allowed to open it up and look inside and wow. Measure it out. I pulled some of the modules out, I photographed everything. And that was the third video that I've put up on YouTube as well, just for a, you know, sort of,
fascinating.
That's, you know, somebody asked me a while ago, so how did that feel like opening up that computer? And I said, you know, I think I know how the guys who opened up Tutankhamun's cave and went in and saw all the gold. I know exactly how that feels, because when you open that thing, it's just gold. It's literally all the connections are gold. All the chips, the leads are gold. It's that thing shines. It's pure gold.
Amazing stuff.
Yeah.
But you got a whole box of those readers. Where do they come from?
The ones that I've got is all from Flight 202. So that's all the Flight 202 modules that I showed on the video.
And you bought them from eBay?
No, I didn't buy them. Those were unknown to me just to extract the data from them.
Right, gotcha, yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to do it last year. I couldn't do it exactly the way I wanted to do it. I needed some more time with it. So the guy, sort of agreed, it's fine, you know, sort of, and we talked about it, and he said, okay, as long as I insure the shipment and it's like really safe and locked up and everything, I lock it up in the safe every night after I've done with it. So these things are incredibly valuable.
And he allowed you to take them just to, so that the code could be taken off for posterity.
That's right, and that's quite amazing. I mean, I'm incredibly thankful for what he's done and the faith that he had in me for not blowing these things up and burning them out, or, you know, destroying them in any way.
That is to be commended. It must be said.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, cool. And so how did you end up in hospital then?
In hospital? No, I
don't get that one. X-ray
machine. Oh, you mean like that, yeah. No, it's a house friend of ours. And, I had these modules and I was like, really, I needed to know what it looks like inside. I've got these videos, but I don't know if these videos is actually this thing. It looks like it, but I can't really say. And the videos doesn't show everything. So I contacted the guy and I said, you know, if I fly down from Pretoria to Durban, which is a 1 hour flight, would you be able to x-ray these things for me? And he says, yeah, sure, you know, come through and let's x-ray them. So we arrived there, and then Saturday morning we went into his hospital and stacked the stuff up there, and it was over in 10 minutes, you know, way too quick. I'd love to look more, you know, sort of turn them and look at it from every possible side. But yeah, we had all the information so that was also quite amazing.
Absolutely fascinating stuff. Yeah. As everybody here on HBR knows, I'm fascinated by this. But really, really, I had no idea how advanced their kit was. You can see.
Yeah.
The chips are, larger versions of what you have today, but not a million miles from what you could buy on your local component store. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you look at these chips in the guidance computer, it's like somebody came from the 1990s, 2000s. And did a little bit of time travel and going back to the 60s, because these are all surface mount components. They're not through hole components. They don't look like anything built in the 70s. They're surface mount components, and they weren't soldered. They were actually welded to that board, because solder was sort of deemed too not reliable enough for spaceflight. So each component was actually physically welded to the PC board.
Would that not damage the connector, the chip itself?
Not at all, because they, you know, the way they did it, probably the current wasn't flowing through the chip. It was just flowing through that small track where they had to weld it to. So these chips came with extremely long leads, and they would sort of place them on the PC board and then spot weld them to the tracks on the PC board.
Yeah.
And then they would cut off the little excess pins, you know, on that. But it's surface mount. It's exactly what you would expect in a computer today. If you look at it, it's surface mount components, and they were quite small as well.
I'm putting photos and stuff into the show notes as we're going along here, so people will be able to see some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you going now? You're going to release the code and put in the third video up?
That's right, yes. So I've captured all the data from the rogue memories already. The signals, sometimes I need to put a little bit of filtering on it. There's some noise on some of the signals. What I also do is I capture the same signal, you know, X number of times, and then I, you know, average it out in case there's a glitch or a small little something that shouldn't have happened. And then just going through that and just making sure that it's in the right order, the bytes, you know, are correct, and everything's correct. And then I'm not very good at digital signal processing. So, you know, that's where I'm going to stop with it. I'm going to release all this data and say, okay, who's going to be the first guy to crack the first microcomputer software? You know, and it's easy to see if you've cracked it, because there's a checksum in the memory. Every 1 kilowords of data has got a checksum. So if you've pulled all the data out and the checksum matches, then you've got it.
Cool. That is, that's just amazing. I'm here looking at your setup, and you've got the rope memory module wired up to the three different boards.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a little computer there, a little Intel computer?
Yeah, it's a little computer called a Red Pataya, and it's a Linux-based computer, and it's got two really high-speed analog outputs and two very high-speed analog inputs. So I can capture up to 125 million samples per second. You know, so it's effectively a two-channel oscilloscope,
yep,
and a two-channel signal generator for me. So it was the ideal kind of thing to just put separately, you know, on a board that I can, it's a self-contained kind of system. It would read the memories. I connect it to my PC through a network cable or through Wi-Fi, and then I get all the data as it's captured, you know, being sent to my computer.
So you're capturing the essentially oscilloscope output.
That's right, yes.
And then you're going to need to break that down into ones and zeros.
That's right, yes. So you see the waveform, and, you know, with a naked eye, I can look at that and I can say, that's a one, that's a zero, that's a one. You know, I can pick them out.
Yeah, it's obvious.
Somebody needs to write a program to say, okay, I can pick up all these zeros and ones reliably. There's one, and I have to mention that as well. There's one little snag on one of the rogue memories. I found that one diode in that rogue memory is a little bit ill, a little bit sick. So you get data out of that bit, but it's not, I can't even say if it's reliable. But fortunately, with that specific rogue, because you have the parity, the 16th bit, which is a parity, you can actually work it backwards. You can say what it should have been if the parity would match.
This memory is nearly 50 years old now, and you're talking about one bit.
Yeah.
My God, this is what you should be putting your family photos on.
That's right.
An awful lot of knitting, though.
Yeah, you can end up with a lot. Yeah, no, sure. I mean, it's 8 kilobytes per module, so you can just imagine you could probably put a low resolution photo on there.
Wow, amazing stuff.
Yeah.
So, yes, okay, all I can say is you should be hanging up and finishing off this video, because I'm fascinated to see it. Actually, you know what I'd love you to do is just point a video at that and start at address one and work your way the whole way through. I would have that as my screensaver and work.
I'll do that for you. Yeah, sure.
You sent me an email, or you were saying that there was an announcement today on one of the mailing lists. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, I just received an email from Ron Berkey. He's the sort of main guy who's been driving, everything about the Apollo guidance computer and the other sort of computers used in the Apollo program. He's been the guy who got a lot of the documentation and sharing all of that. He's doing it without any pay, just because of it's nice. And he actually sent an email out to the news group this morning saying that all of a sudden we've now got a lot of new things that came out. So initially we had the Apollo 11, the lunar module code, and we had the command module code, but it was all late, kind of 1969 kind of code that we've got. And one of the guys who wrote the software for the lunar module landing, the physical code that landed the lunar module, he had some printouts with him. And it's amazing stuff that he had with him. And they are now busy scanning all of this. This needs to be transcribed. So if anybody is interested in any volunteers who want to help transcribe that into a digital format, we've got all these thousands of pages of incredibly interesting documentation and software that's all of a sudden became available this morning. And we need to get this in electronic format. We've got a simulator for the Apollo guidance computer that Ron Berkey also wrote. And we can now, if we've got it all transcribed into a digital format, we can run it on this computer and we can sort of see exactly how it executed. You know, we'll have the first code, and the code that I've extracted from Flight 202 predates a lot of that code, but it's part of the way. We need to make sure that the emulator and everything is working. That's why we need all of this code, sort of converted into a digital format. But all of that is all of a sudden, just this morning, became available. It's not even published completely because they're still busy scanning it, but it's going to be available quite soon.
Fantastic. We never actually said where the guy found the memory modules. Do you want to tell them that?
Yeah, that's the most amazing part. He was actually he knew a guy who was a chemical engineer, and this guy bought a whole bunch, tons and tons of scrap metal from a NASA auction to melt down and extract all the precious metals and so on. And he went by this guy's storage facility, and he saw all of this junk lying around there. And he said, "But what's that? That looks like an engine. That looks like what is this thing?" And it's got NASA. And he took everything that had the words NASA on it, or that looked like some kind of electronics. And he ended up buying 3 tons worth of scrap metal from this guy. Wow. And it was days before this bunch of stuff would have been shipped to, I think, Taiwan or someplace to be recycled.
Melted down.
That's right. And he just grabbed whatever he could. He went home, he went back, and he got some more stuff, and he brought as much as he could back to his home. And he actually paid for those things. Over time, he started sort of sifting through that and threw all the junk away and sold some of the parts. And then one day he realized he had a full, perfect Apollo guidance computer. He had the real thing, the thing that the computer that was probably used to develop the software on. He had that because it was just a metal box. You couldn't see any chips, any circuits. When they opened that up, here was all the entire computer inside the box. So, yeah, he was...
How was that actually wired? How did the modules fit in? How did it all come together?
The computer is basically, it's two in two parts. So if you undo all the screws around it, and then you split it up, split it basically in the middle, and there's two parts of it. And then the first part would contain all the memories, the RAM, the rope memory modules would slot into that, and everything to do with the software, the RAM and the memories would be in that one part of the computer. And then the other part of the computer was probably 90% of that was the digital circuits, the modules that contained the chips, and that made up the processor on the computer. And there was the last section on that is just interface sort of circuitry that would interface to the rest of the spacecraft.
And what sort of language did they use for programming this? Presumably assembly or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was all written in assembler, but when they started doing like the really really tense math, the matrix, you know, multiplications and the really complex mathematical formulas, then assembler, you know, you could do it in assembler, but you would take an awful long time to do that. So they actually created something, an interpreted language. So you would write it as part of the assembler. So you would write assembly instructions, and then you would say, I'm going to start executing this interpreted language. It's just one instruction that says start interpreted language interpreter or whatever. And then you would use different instructions, not assembly language instructions. Now, that first instruction that says start doing the interpreted language thing is actually a call to a subroutine. And the subroutine then goes and reads all the next instructions out of the memory.
Yeah.
And it interprets that. It does all sorts of complex, floating point math. And when it's done with it, it just returns to the end of that list of interpreted instructions. And then the program just carries on like normal. So you had two languages, the assembly language and then a much higher interpreted kind of language.
Absolutely awesome stuff. So there's a few, if people wanted to get into this, into assisting here, first start, why are you doing this? What is the benefit to humankind in order to be able to do this?
I have to be honest, it's for me, it's incredibly interesting. You know, every other week you make a new discovery and you find something new that nobody's known, and it's like hacking, except it's not illegal, you know. So nobody's gonna, you know, come after you for cracking that code and figuring out how these things are working. It's really interesting to work on it. But I think one of the things that I've and this wasn't the initial sort of idea, but one of the things that I've realized is that, you know, there's a lot to be learned from the Apollo space program. If you work in any kind of environment where you do projects and you work with customers and you have deadlines and you have meetings, and all of that happened in the Apollo program. And they did it wrong at one point, and then they discovered what they did wrong. They fixed it, and it was hugely successful after that. So there's a lot to learn from the way that was done. There's a reason why they managed to get to the moon, and why the Russians couldn't get to the moon. And that's because of the ways the projects was managed and the way the people were communicating, the way they were doing things. So that's one of the things that I've learned quite a lot, or found very interesting. And that wasn't something that I initially thought that I would learn from that.
To be honest, I was not expecting that as an answer.
It's
doing a wild ride. But that is where would I find more information on that, on the management side of it? Because now I'm actually interested.
Yeah, it's, I can't out of the fist tell you all the websites, but it's literally, if you start Googling for, you know, the Apollo guidance computer and MIT and NASA, and you get to these repositories where they have all these PDFs, the scanned documents, then you see the meetings, you know, you see the minutes of the meetings where the guy said, you know, this is not going to work, you know. So like MIT says, we're going to build this computer. And then IBM comes in and says, these MIT guys don't have a clue of what a computer works like. They've never built a computer. We are the computer experts. You know, we can build this much, much better than they can. And then they come up with a solution, which is actually pretty crappy, sorry. But MIT have to defend their position and say, this is a better computer. And in the end, you know, they prevailed, and the better solution actually, you know, was used. It's exactly the same today. If you work in that environment, you'll recognize a lot of those things. And it's like, I've been there, done that, seen that.
not always the best choice wins in my previous experience, but okay, there you go.
Yep. It's true.
Wow. This is a... So if people want to help, there's the helping transcode the scan pages, which I guess anyone can do. The techies amongst you out there, you will have data feeds that they can go through and convert to binary, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And anything else that we can do to help?
I think, you know, it's basically it's less than 3 years before the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing. So I'm pretty sure things are still going to pick up a lot. A lot of extra things are probably going to come to the fore. And we're going to discover a lot of new things. I was already contacted by people who said, you know, I've got an LVDC, and I had to go and Google what is an LVDC, and it was the computer controlling the rocket. People who say, yes, I've got this, I've got that. So I think videos like this, you know, it's just going to spark more interest, and more things are going to come out, and more people are going to open their safes and say, okay, I've actually got this software. You can scan it. You can, you know,
work exactly. with it and play with it.
And yeah, it's going to get quite exciting, you know, going forward.
If anything, you're increasing the value of what you have by making it public, because the code that they're using there
exactly.
came from my thing here, which is
that's right,
absolutely excellent. Yeah. The kit that that you have built, crude though it may be, is that available, or is that useful for other people if they had modules, or can they build their own, or would that be useful?
I don't really have a circuit diagram of it at all. It was like sort of tweaked until I got it exactly right. I probably should go back and, you know, measure it out and do a final version of that. I can probably make the relay boards, the circuits and the printed circuit board of that. I can make that available. It's not brain surgery to build something like that, but it's actually been pretty useful, and I would probably use it in other projects, you know, in future as well. So it's, if anybody's interested, I could probably sort of let them have a copy of that circuit diagram and PC board layouts as well.
Perfect. Tell me, what is your email address, or how can we contact you?
I think, the best is to leave like a message on YouTube. I can probably give my email address. I don't mind people emailing me. You know, I don't always get back immediately the same day, but I will always get back to you eventually. You can just email me F Rautenbach. I'm going to spell that. It's F R A U T E N B A C H @gmail.com.
Perfect. And I'll put in links to your website, to the YouTube channel, and people can derive that name from there. Okay, is there anything I missed in this at all?
I think we've pretty much covered it. I can probably talk about a lot of these things. There's a lot of other interesting things not really related to the computer, but that I think that would be a separate talk for another day. I think we've pretty much covered.
As you know, this is this is me doing my plug, and everybody's going, oh, Ken's at it again. But seriously, all you need to do is just record a show, pick a slot, and upload it. This is right up our folks' alley. So if you have anything that you just want to get off your chest, you send it to us, or do a YouTube video on it as well. I'm subscribed.
Will do.
Okay. Francois, thank you very, very much. I'm sorry it took so long to get back to you and do the scheduling last night. We had actually originally planned to do this last night, and I completely got sidetracked with the kids, the stuff we needed to do for the kids. So major apologies for that. But thank you very much for doing this.
No problem at all. Again, thanks a lot for allowing me to be on your show.
Not at all. Tech. Rockets, spacecraft, what more could I ask for? All right, thanks very much.
Okay, goodbye.
Okay, folks, that was it. As you know, HPR is a community podcast network, so tune in tomorrow for another exciting episode of Hacker Public Radio.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.